How would rhinos do conjuring? Yes, it is a strange question, but no, we have not taken leave of our senses. In fact, it's our senses that lead us to ask the question in particular, the most important sense in judging wine, which also happens to be our weakest, the sense of smell. Now let's keep the rhino in the back of our mind for a moment. Let's think about ourselves first. We are primarily creatures of sight. Hearing comes second, then taste and touch, and finally, poor, underprivileged smell. Yet smell is more important than we think. When we taste wine, or indeed taste anything else, all we can really taste are five basic categories: sweet, sour, salt, bitter, and umami, a Japanese word for what the Western palate might describe as meaty or savoury, and found, for example, in miso, roquefort, ketchup, mushrooms, and broccoli. Those five are the only things we have taste buds for, and everything else we think we're tasting, we're actually smelling. And in comparison with most mammals, we're pretty appalling at it. It's not our fault. Our olfactory lobe is a shriveled little thing withered away by thousands of years of evolution, but to improve upon our pathetic nasal patrimony, we need training. A master of wine's nose is cultivated by years of practice and experience to make fine differentiations which mystify the beginner, who may suspect either trickery or a sort of exquisite boasting. The vocabulary of wine writers has become an object of satire, with its knowing murmurings of pencil shavings and raspberries, of leather and petrol, apples, hay, black currants, and indeed, some say, the drift of aircraft hydraulic fluid from the top of a good Gewürztraminer. But what other choice is there? One of the problems we face is that, being visual animals, so many of our words are based on visual experience. We all know when something's green or rusty or sun-bleached, when it creeps along or rushes past in a blur, whether it's tall or round or angular. But we can only summon up words to describe smells by comparing them to something of which we already know the smell. The problem isn't just for wine writers. Restaurant reviewers, for example, struggle dreadfully to describe the taste, mostly, of course, the smell, of what they're eating, and resort to talking about how it was cooked, how it looked, what was in it, and what the dining room was like. The late John Diamond, journalist and husband of the celebrity cook Nigella Lawson, had almost no repertoire of descriptive language for food. His wife observed calmly over lunch one day that it was a little dispiriting to be married to a man whose only responses to what you fed him were yum or ugh. The other profession which needs an accurate vocabulary of olfaction is, of course, the noses or perfumers, whose art or craft surrounds us all the time, mostly unnoticed unless we encounter something particularly strident. A perfume called Giorgio Beverly Hills was popular in the 1980s. It had all the subtlety of a military brass band exploding in a thunderstorm, and induced one of New York's grander restaurants to have a subtle but unmissable sign on its door reading, "No pipes, no cigars, no Giorgio." Interestingly, perfumers go about it all in a different way from enophiles. Instead of dismantling the olfactory picture in terms of what it reminds your readers or listeners of, you build it up from individual ingredients which you identify by what they remind you of. Here are some real ones. The inside of an expensive lady's handbag, the sandstone dugout when I was little, wet hay, the crowd climbing up to Great Zimbabwe on a hot day, the crush bar at the Royal Opera House, sunlight on old tar ship's ropes, toffee apples at the Goose Fair, and teenager's deodorant. Who'd have thought that they refer respectively to orris, vetiver, coumarin, castoreum, dihydromersenol, immortel sauvage, feltol, and the dreadful calone? So the world of perfumery is a topsy-turvy version of the wine connoisseur's olfactory landscape. A perfumer will sniff a fragrance and think rotten grapefruit, grandma's kitchen, the garden at Le Monsieur, macaroons, oak bark, wet grass, and tomcats. And from this, compile the list of ingredients that went into it. The wine lover has no such luxury. She knows what went into it. Grapes. And so the language must work backwards from the glass to the outside world. The good news, of course, is that it can all be taught. Once you've had your attention drawn to the odour of crushed violets at the base of Chanel No. 5, you will always notice it there in future. Once you know that petrol scent of a good Riesling, you'll be able to identify it on the spot. Sometimes, of course, it doesn't help. The hydraulic fluid of a Gewürztraminer is something you'll just have to take my word for. And what does a rhinoceros have to do with the subject? Simply this. A rhinoceros lives in an olfactory world. Eyesight is way down his list of useful senses. Even time is different for the rhino, who inhabits a sort of spectral world, a world in which the instantaneous demarcation between what's here now and what was here a moment ago simply does not exist. Where we see an empty room, a rhino would smell it, crowded with ghosts, olfactory shadows of varying degrees of translucency. His impressions of the world do not alter with the speed of light, but with the speed of evaporation. Conjuring would mean nothing to a rhino. We see the dove disappear. The rhino could smell it, clearly hidden in the false bottom of the magician's table. So we might take a leap and presume that if rhinos had speech, their vocabulary would be heavily laden with words defining the tiniest distinctions between different smells and the way they blend and linger. Impossible to imagine what such a language would be like, of course, but that is, in a way, what wine writers are trying to achieve. No wonder they sometimes struggle.